Daniel chapter 3. We've seen in the first couple of chapters of Daniel, of course, Daniel and being among that group of Israelites from Judah that were taken captive, part of that first wave, and then they're part of that select group that's brought in to be trained to serve before Nebuchadnezzar. We remember how they refused the food and the drink from the king's table. Whenever at the end of chapter 1 they came before the king after the end of the 3 years, they were found to be 10 times better than all of the others in knowledge and wisdom and all of these things. Of course, in chapter 2 we saw the great dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and he challenged his magicians and Chaldeans and sorcerers and so forth, that not only did he want them to give the interpretation, but they had to give the dream itself. They simply could not do it. They thought it was an unreasonable request. He said they'd be put to death if they did it. Well, they still couldn't. And so the decree went out for them to be killed. But Daniel said, let me talk to the king. He sent his three companions to go and pray for the mercy of God, and that God would reveal the dream. And God did. Daniel interprets that dream with the four kingdoms, but most importantly, the everlasting kingdom that would be set up during those last days. So we come to chapter 3, destruction attempt. The faithful friends fearlessly faced the fiery furnace. That's almost a tongue twister. But Daniel himself is not mentioned in this chapter, but it does focus on those three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's a story, of course, that we've all probably heard from youth. It's a favorite among the kids to hear this story, but there's certainly a very good lesson in it of faithfulness and reliance on God that we see here with these three young people from Judah. And again, keep in mind that these are young people, probably in their mid-teens whenever they're first taken, probably in their early 20s at this point in their life, but certainly far away from their own culture, their own religion, all of those type things. It'd be very easy to give in to the environment in which they're in. First of all, we see the erection of an image and the edict to worship that image. First of all, we see the image itself in verses 1 through 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent together the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Well, it's often wondered, is this a representation of Nebuchadnezzar himself? Certainly we don't know whether it was or not. It very well could be. We know that he was a very prideful man. That pride's going to get him in trouble in the next chapter, here in chapter 4. We also know from chapter 2 that he was the head of gold of this image that he saw in the dream. But many people think it was an image of Nebuchadnezzar, but simply, again, we don't know whether it was or not. But what we do know is that its means was to honor the pagan king's god, or gods. It was an object of worship. Whatever the image itself may have been, it was to be worshipped. That was its purpose. And of course, that's where these Jewish exiles are going to have a problem. Its size, we see that it was 60 cubits high. Well, again, a cubit is about 18 inches from the elbow to the end of the longest finger. About 18 inches for the average man. So we're talking about 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. This is a huge image that's been set up. And he calls it an image of gold. Now, most likely it was probably overlaid in gold. That's what most of the things were at that time. If it was certainly pure gold, it was something else being that size. But then we see its dedication. All these officials are summoned to come from all of the empire are summoned to come there to Babylon to the dedication of this image. And so it says they stand before the image. They all come. They're all assembled. And they stand before the image. Well, what are they going to do? The edict is read in verses 4 and 5. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up." Well, there's not a whole lot of wiggle room in that, is there? It's pretty plain what they're to do. He says, "You are commanded." And it's a commandment to the people, nations, and languages. That's all inclusive. And so no one in the entire empire was exempt from worshiping this image. It's often asked, well, where is Daniel? And again, we simply don't know. The text doesn't tell us. It never mentions Daniel. So we don't know where he was. I would assume that he was not there. But again, we simply don't know what the issue was with Daniel. We see musical instruments that were, whenever certain music was made on those musical instruments, that was the signal. That was the time to fall down and worship this image. But again, the demand is purely a religious one. They're to worship this image. He says, fall down and worship the image. Prostration, that the position of prostration was a preparatory action for worship, and the position that accompanied worship itself. Now, when it says to fall down before it, it either means to literally lay flat on the ground, or at least to get on one's knees and bow down with the forehead and the palms of the hands on the ground. But it's paying homage to this idol. That's what they're being called to do. This image that represents these pagan gods, whatever it represents, to fall down and worship it, of course, would be against the laws of Israel. Well, there's a warning that goes along with it. We not only have the command to fall down and worship, but also there's a warning. What's going to happen if you don't? Verses 6 and 7. "And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the people heard the sound of the pipe, of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." You know, he's pretty serious about what he's saying here. The punishment's pretty stout, to be burned in a fiery furnace. Cruel punishments were not at all uncommon among the Assyrians or the Babylonians. In fact, they were indeed very common. Jeremiah talks in Jeremiah 29, verse 22. Says, "Because of them, this curse shall be used by all the exiles from Judah and Babylon. The Lord make you like Zedekiah and Ahab, whom the king of Babylon roasted in the fire." Now, this was not something that was unusual for them. In fact, one of the most ancient writings that we have in our possession today is an artifact that's called the Code of Hammurabi. Hammurabi was a ruler in the first Babylonian dynasty, from 1792 B.C. to 1750 B.C. Well, if you remember our dates here, with this Daniel went to Babylon in 605 B.C. And so we're talking some 1,100 years, even before Nebuchadnezzar, that Hammurabi had ruled over Babylon. And that Code of Hammurabi talks about punishment by burning in fire. And so this was evidently something that had been a practice in Babylon for many, many years. So the punishment's very harsh. burnt, thrown into a burning fiery furnace. Now, probably these furnaces was the furnace that they used to make bricks. That was a common thing that they, a common building material that they made. I don't know how hot the furnaces were to make bricks in Babylon. I used to haul bricks from a little brick plant down in DeHaenas, Texas, down by San Antone. And I know talking to them that their kilns were 1,800 degrees that they baked their bricks in. They said that other types of clay, some places were 2,000 degrees. Well, that's pretty hot. In fact, you could walk by those and feel, even if there was the slightest crack, you could feel the heat coming out of those. And so that something along that chord is what was being used here in Babylon. Well, refusal was evidently expected, that there might be some that would refuse, and thus the penalty is put in place. You either do it, or you're going to be thrown into the fiery furnace. Now, it'd be regarded as treason. Because the king had said to do it, you better do it, or face the penalty. Well, again, our Jewish exiles are going to have a problem with this. Being monotheist, not believing in many gods as the Babylonians did, but in one God, Jehovah, they're not able to worship anyone or anything other than Jehovah. They're not going to be able to bow down and worship this image that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. So what are they going to do? Well, we see an example of faith and refusal to worship the idol, verses 8 through 12. First of all, we have the Chaldeans' accusation. We have some tattletales on the scene that are going to come running to Nebuchadnezzar and tell that these Jewish exiles are not bowing down to his image. It says, therefore, at this time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. So they come, they're reminding the king of the decree that he's made. I'm sure he was well aware of it. But it says that they used malicious accusation. They're not coming out of real concern for anything about the king or his decree or anything else. But maliciously accusing literally means they ate their pieces. A common idiom for slander. They're coming slandering these Jewish exiles, trying to get them into trouble. Well, the accusation was probably based upon jealousy. Remember back at the end of chapter 2, after Daniel had told the dream and its interpretation, he's raised to a powerful position in Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar, but he also requests that his three friends be put in powerful positions as well, and they are. And so, most likely jealousy that's causing these people to want to get rid of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The accusation implies a charge of ingratitude, if you look at verse 12. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He said, these men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you've set up. And so certain men whom you have appointed, king, you've singled them out and given them this high position, and they're not even appreciative of it. They pay no attention to you, king. They could care less about your decree. So again, just trying to stir the pot. Well, unfortunately, it works. We move on into verses 13 through 18. Entrust their souls to God. We're going to see, again, great faith on the part of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. First of all, we see the anger of the king. Verse 13. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. The literal meaning there is in rage and hot wrath. Whenever Nebuchadnezzar hears that there's some there that have not bowed before his image, have not obeyed his command, he's just, beside himself with anger. Just about to lose control. Well, such fury was common among kings, among rulers. They were used to getting their way. They had the power of life and death in their hand. They were used to whenever they told a person to do something, that person did it. No questions asked. And they got very angry when that did not happen. We see that with King Ahasuerus, or better known in history as King Xerxes, the king in Esther. We see his anger in Esther chapter 1, verse 12, again in chapter 7, verse 7. The anger. And again, it was common with these kings. But the king's anger revealed that these Chaldeans, these tattletales, had indeed achieved their desired effect. They wanted the king to be angry with these men. Certainly, he is angry with them. The appeal of the king, verses 14 and 15. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, now he's called Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to him. He answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I've set up?" You know, it's interesting as you think about even setting up this golden image and the question that he's asking, that back in chapter 2, he had acknowledged at the end of that chapter, after Daniel is able to tell his dream and the interpretation, he acknowledges that Israelite's God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings. But now he's, again, he never gave up his polytheistic ways, and he's wanting them to bow down before this image. Verse 15, "Now if you're ready, when you hear the sound of the harp, of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I've made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." He's giving them a second chance. And again, that's very rare with these kings. They were evidently men that he liked. Again, he had found them 10 times greater than all the others at the end of chapter 1. He promotes them to this position at the end of chapter 2. He's giving them a second chance. If you'll go ahead and fall down and worship, then all is well and good. But if you won't, you're going to be cast into the fiery furnace. And then notice what he says at the end of verse 15. "And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" You're going into the fiery furnace, and what God is able to deliver you out of the hands of powerful King Nebuchadnezzar? Very arrogant statement. And maybe at this time, maybe he's thinking about the God of Israel, the God of Daniel, and how that he is a powerful God, that he is a God of gods and Lord of kings. But even with the power to give the dream and its interpretation, still, what kind of a God can deliver human flesh out of a oven, hundreds or thousands of degree heat? What kind of God can do that? Well, in Nebuchadnezzar's mind, obviously no God can. And that's what he's bringing out. So he says, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, is it true that you've disobeyed, that you have not done what I asked you to?" And so even though he's very angry with them, again, he gives them the opportunity to deny the charge. He probably even suspected that these Chaldeans had brought this charge, maybe because of jealousy. And so he's giving them the chance to answer. Again, who is the God who can deliver you, that can rescue you, that can release you? What sort of God can do that? Well, certainly no God that Nebuchadnezzar was used to. He's used to all of these various gods that he served, but really they couldn't do anything because they weren't gods at all. And so he's used to very gods that are very limited in power. We see that that type of thinking with several people as we go through the history of the Israelites, different ones that they encounter that serve pagan gods, and the encounters with the Assyrians in the book of Isaiah. In Isaiah chapter 36, verses 19 and 20, we've got Rabshakeh from Assyria, and he's come to the king of Israel, and he says, "Where are the gods of Hamath and Orpah? Where are the gods of Saravim? Have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? Who among all the gods of these lands has delivered their lands out of my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand?" As he comes to the king of Jerusalem who's standing up against him, he's reminding him, look at all of these nations that I've conquered. And all of those nations had their gods. What of those gods was able to deliver them? Well, none of them were, because they weren't gods at all. And so, in his mind, if those nations' gods could not deliver them, then Israel's God would not be able to deliver them as well. The next chapter in Isaiah 37, beginning in verse 10, we've got Sennacherib of Assyria. He says, "Thus shall you speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah, do not let your God in whom you trust deceive you by promising that Jerusalem will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria." He's not only reminding them of these gods of these other nations that couldn't save them, but he's saying, Israel, don't let your God deceive you into thinking that he can. Continues on, verse 11, "Behold, you have heard that the king of Assyria has done to all lands, devoting them to destruction. And shall you be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered them, the nations that my fathers destroyed? Gazon, Haran, Respa, and the people of Eden who were in Telezer?" Look at all these nations and all their gods. None of them were able to deliver. So Israel, don't let your God deceive you into thinking he can deliver you, because he's no more powerful than the others. Well, again, they certainly didn't understand the true God, the God of Israel. But that's basically what Nebuchadnezzar is asking. Who is the God? You know, here I am, the king, the great Nebuchadnezzar, the ruler over the world at that time. Who can deliver you out of my hand? Well, in verses 16 through 18, we have the answer. That's what Kevin read for us earlier. "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up.'" They say, "We have no need to answer you in this matter." They're not being arrogant or fanatical in these words. They're simply stating the fact that of the truthfulness of the charge. They don't try to give a defense. They don't make an apology for what they've done. He said, "Is it true? You know, go and fall down before the image and everything will be well." I said, "No, we have no defense. We're still standing in the same place. Their minds were made up. The action that they were going to pursue was refusal to worship. That's the answer to the king. We will not worship your God." You know, living does not need an oral defense. Great living, proper living, Christian living, faithful living does not need an oral defense. You know, when someone starts telling me how great they are, that's usually a kind of a red flag. You know, are you trying to convince me or are you trying to convince yourself? You know, let your life speak for itself. That's what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are doing. They have no need to answer the king. Their actions are speaking for themselves. They're casting themselves completely on God, relying completely on Him. Similar in their situations, a little bit different, not really that much, I guess, but a similar statement to what we see some of the apostles making. In Acts chapter 4, verse 19, when Peter and John are before the Sanhedrin, and they answered, "Whether it is right in the sight of God to listen to you rather than God, you must judge." In other words, they're saying the same thing. We're going to stand with God. Again, in Acts chapter 5, verse 29, Peter and the apostles answered, "We must obey God rather than men." In Galatians chapter 1, verse 10, Paul writes, "For I am now seeking the approval of man or of God. Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." And so a person's priorities have to be right. Even in the face of persecution, even in the face of death, we stand solid upon our faith. And so their commitment, their reliance upon God is totally complete. "If this be so," they say, "our God is able," verse 17. The God is able to deliver them from that fire. King Nebuchadnezzar has asked the question, "Who is the God who will deliver you?" They're saying, "Our God can." They don't know for sure if it's going to be His will, His choice to deliver them or not. But they have no doubt in His ability. And they're leaving it in His hands. That He can deliver them. It's His choice whether He does. If not, verse 18, "Still we will not serve your gods." They in no way will compromise their faith. Even if God chooses not to deliver them out of that furnace, let Him do according to His will. But King, we're not going to serve your image. And we're not going to worship any other God. Well, certainly, their great faith deserves to be listed in that great Hebrew chapter of faith, Hebrews chapter 11, doesn't it? And it is there in verse 34. They're not named by person, but it says, as it's listing some of the things these people went through, it says in verse 34, "quenched the power of fire." I think that's talking about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, what they went through. But notice it says, "Either way, He will deliver us out of your hand, O God." If you put us in the furnace and He takes us out, He's delivered us out of your hand. If you put us in the furnace and He chooses to let us remain there, He still delivered us out of your hand. You have no power and no say in this, Nebuchadnezzar. Well, then we come to the execution and the result of it, chapter 9, verses 19 through 30. Their sentence and the destruction. Beginning verse 19, "And Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace." So the furnace is heated 7 times more. 7 was a complete number. We don't know if it's a literal 7 or just heated to its just as hot as it will go. But either case, it's extremely, extremely hot. Certain strong men are appointed to this cruel execution. The fire is so hot that it literally takes their life as they go up near the entrance to this furnace to cast them in. Notice they fell down bound and clothed in the fiery furnace, bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, their other garments. There they are. You'd think with this heat that's in this furnace, you know, it would all be over in seconds. May not even take a second. Just disintegration almost. But that's not what happens. There's salvation, there's deliverance. The king is astonished. Verses 24 and 25. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see four men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Well, that certainly wasn't what Nebuchadnezzar was expecting to see, was it? I don't know if he could see through the door, or if there was a window, or how he was seeing in, but he could obviously see in and witness what was going on in this furnace. He's expecting instant disintegration. But no, he sees them in there walking around, unbound, and instead of three, there are four. Evidently, the fire destroyed the bonds that these men are bound with, but it does not hurt the men. The king identifies this fourth man as like a son of the gods. The meaning is a son of deity, a divine person, one of the race of gods, a supernatural being. The word angel in verse 28 is an Aramaic word that stands for a designation of deity. Now we know from the Bible that angels are not deity. But the Babylonians believed that angels were deity. That was a false notion they had. But who is this fourth person? Well, we're really not told, certainly, and so we can't be dogmatic as to who it is. All we have is Nebuchadnezzar's description, and he doesn't know. He's just trying to describe it the best he can. Possibly an angel. Again, verse 28. Possibly a pre-incarnate son of God, the angel of Jehovah, and parents of Jesus Christ. Possibly God Himself. In fact, that's a promise that God made to them back in Isaiah chapter 43, verses 1 and following. He says, "But now thus says the Lord, He who created you, O Jacob, He who formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by my name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. I gave Egypt as your ransom, Cush and Seba in exchange for you." And so a promise from God that He would be with them. Now again, that description could fit either the Father or the Son. But certainly, someone from God is there in that furnace with them. A protector is there. And they're not hurt. Well, we see the king's acknowledgement in verses 26 and 27. "Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, 'Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here.' Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of these men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not burned, and no smell of fire had come upon them." Well, the king, again, he doesn't rise above his paganistic ways. He acknowledges God as he calls out to them, servants of the Most High God, but this is also a term that he used for Zeus and others within his pantheon of gods. But he's merely showing again a belief that Israel's God is evidently very powerful. He's ranking him right up there at the top of the gods, even though he's not putting away the other gods. Great miracle. Notice the fire had no power over them. There's no change in their appearance. There's no smell of the fire on them. You know, if you just get around a fire, get around people that are smoking, get in sometime a a restaurant or something where people are smoking, it gets new clothes very easily, doesn't it? There's no smell of the fire. Their clothing's not scorched. Their hair is not singed. It's pretty easy to singe your hair, especially on your arm when you're reaching out there doing something. The hair is not even singed, though they've been in this furnace of no telling what heat. So a great miracle has taken place. Nebuchadnezzar recognizes the power, but again, he's not yet willing to do away with his other gods. Then they're standing, the decree, verses 28 through 30. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants." Again, note this, as it calls it an angel there, but this is Nebuchadnezzar talking. He's really not sure who this is. He sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Now, it started out with a decree, didn't it? A decree to come and worship this image. Everybody has to bow down to it. Now he says, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Again, he's not saying there's not another God, but there's no other God that can do what this God did. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So the king at least acknowledges that there is a God who can deliver. What did he say back in verse 15? What God can deliver you out of my hand? He didn't think there was one, but now he has to admit there is. The God of Israel could. The king shows great respect for the faith and the conviction that these three men have. He decrees a punishment to those who would blaspheme Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. And then he promotes the three. They got a promotion at the end of chapter 2. They're getting a promotion again at the end of chapter 3. So it's interesting as we look at the chapter, and it begins with this decree to worship this image. An image honoring Babylon's God. Nebuchadnezzar's God, or his gods, probably a certain God though. And it ends up with this decree to honor the God of the Israelites, who showed to be so much more powerful than these gods that they served. The faithfulness of these Israelite captives is having an impact. We saw it in chapter 2 with Daniel. We see it in chapter 3. We're going to continue to see it as we look at the events that unfold. These pagan people and pagan religions are being influenced by these men and their faith as they stand up for Jehovah. It's also interesting that those motivated by jealousy to rid themselves of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego instead see them honored even more because of their faithfulness. So what an example. It's not just a children's story. There are certainly many good examples for us as we look at the lives that these young men live and the faith that they had. Lesson is yours. Is anyone here this evening who needs to respond to the Lord's invitation? That invitation is open. If you need to be baptized for the remission of your sins, if you need to respond in any way, if you'd let that be known as we stand and sing.